Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be with St. George's today and getting to know Ben here, and I already know Cal. I feel already among friends, and so it's a delight to be with you. And it especially pleases me that you've been reading the Gospel of Mark and paying close attention to what it says. The Gospel of Mark is near and dear to me, I suppose, partly because I see it as the underdog gospel, right? Like, the Gospel of Matthew was the earliest church's favorite gospel, kind of for their life. And the Gospel, according to St. John, was their favorite gospel for doctrine. And the Gospel, according to Luke, was their favorite gospel for history. And Mark, not so much. Mark is a gospel that has been suffering indignities from the day it was written. And probably the first indignities that the Gospel of Mark suffered were to be effaced by the Gospel of Matthew on the one hand and the Gospel of Luke on the other. Now, we're not going to get into the question of like which gospel is written first or how they're related to each other. Just to say that across theological stripes, there's a general consensus that Mark was the first gospel written, and that both Matthew and Luke had access to and made use of the Gospel of Mark when they wrote theirs. It's not unlikely that both Matthew and Luke thought that, having done what they did with the help of Mark, that Mark was a gospel that could be dispensed with. But thanks be to God and his sovereignty, and because of the apostolic origins of the Gospel of Mark, it's always been there, number two, in the fourfold Christian canon of the New Testament. And so our theme this morning is going to be the Gospel according to Mark, Mark the underestimated storyteller. Now, besides the implicit commentary of Matthew and Luke in using Mark but writing over Mark to write their Gospels, the first actual commentary, first statement we have external to the Gospel of Mark that describes its character comes from a bishop named Papias. Papias was the bishop of Hierapolis about the very early first century, maybe about 110 or so. He writes these words about the Gospel of Mark. Whether you can read them or not, it doesn't matter too much. You'll get this flavor of this. Just think about why is Papias saying this about the Gospel of Mark. He says, and John the presbyter also said this, Mark being the interpreter, or that could be translator, but probably interpreter, of Peter, okay, the Apostle Peter. So we have it on earliest authority that Mark comes to us, is sponsored by Peter. Okay, whatsoever he recorded, he wrote with great accuracy. Good job, Mark, way to go. But not, however, in the order in which it was spoken or done by our Lord. Let not your hearts be troubled. Okay, just the same. For he neither heard nor followed our Lord, but, as before said, he was in the company with Peter, who gave such instruction as was necessary, but not to give a history of our Lord's discourses. You see what's going on here? They're sort of like, he did a great job. He did the best he could. Right? They say both of these things at the same time. Already, it's clear from what Papias is saying that the Gospel of Mark suffers from a little bit of underestimation. It's rough. It's not orderly. It's not refined. But he did really do his best, and it's on Peter's authority. Wherefore, Mark has not erred in anything but writing some things as he has recorded them. For he was carefully attentive to one thing, not to pass by anything that he heard or to state anything falsely in these accounts. So Mark hangs on to his place in the canon by the hair of its chinny chin chin, right? Just, okay, it may not be great, but it does come from Peter. And Mark hasn't made any mistakes in what he did, but he had limited resources. All right, my first commentary on Mark. I'm just citing Papias here to say that Mark has been fighting an uphill climb ever since then. And we're going to see if, in fact, Mark isn't a little better than even the ancients might have thought. So our theme is Mark the underestimated storyteller. And our question is, Mark, bad writer or a good storyteller? There are abundant evidences that Mark was told before it was written. Mark was told, the gospel that is, was told before it was written, or we might say written in order to be told. Mark is a gospel that is made for and arose from oral performance. I can prove this to you, I believe, by noting a number of features that are characteristic of Mark's gospel. First of all, Mark don't write so good. Mark ain't a grammarian. And we get a sense for Mark's style, or in some ways his lack of style, if we compare him to a compadre in the gospel writing business, the author of the Gospel of Luke. Luke begins his gospel this way. First, he clears his throat delicately. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things which have been accomplished among us, just as they were delivered to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, it seemed good also to me, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account to you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the truth concerning the things of which you have been informed. That's how you write, people. That's how you write. You start your book with inasmuch, which is a word as effete in English as it was in Greek. Epidepar, Luke says. Probably with a British accent. Which, you know, is outrageous. But I'm pretty sure that's what he's doing. Well, Mark don't write like that. Mark makes grammatical mistakes. At the end of that great story of the stilling of the seas, Mark says, even the wind and the sea obeys him. No, it don't, Mark. That's a compound subject, and it needs a third-person plural verb, which Matthew and Luke both knew, and they fixed it. Matthew and Luke are copy editors of Mark, and they're fixing his grammar all the time. So Mark don't write so good. Mark is full of redundancies as he writes. Why use one word when you could use more? Is Mark's slogan. So Mark says things like this. When evening came and the sun was setting. Gotcha, Mark. That's what evening is. It's the sun setting. Right? And so Matthew looks at that and just says, when evening came. Luke looks at that and says, as the sun was setting. We don't need both. Right? Or Mark will say, and immediately the leprosy left him, and he was cleansed. Same thing, Mark. Leprosy left him, he was cleansed. Same idea. Once again, Luke says the leprosy left him, Matthew says he was cleansed. Or is a lamp brought in order to be placed under a bushel basket or under a bed? Same thing happens here. Matthew says bushel basket, Luke says bed. Mark likes both. So we have this interesting phenomenon. Whenever Mark tells a story that you also see in Matthew or also see in Luke, or in both, even though Mark is the shortest gospel by far, about 55 to 60%, in length of either of those two, Mark always uses the most words to tell the same story. Right? And like good copy editors, especially good copy editors when papyrus is very expensive, who have a lot more to say than Mark has to say, Matthew and Luke whittle him down typically to the bare essentials. You maybe have noticed this in Mark. Did you notice how many times he says immediately? Did you notice that when you were reading? It's Greek word euthus. Euthus? Euthus? Mark has a fixation on the word euthus immediately. He says it all the time, even more than you can discern from the English translation. Indeed, Mark uses this word 41 times. In his gospel, that's 55 to 60% as long as any of the other gospels. He uses the word 41 times. Matthew uses it 5 times. in a gospel that's 140% the length of Mark. John uses it three times in a gospel that's not parallel. Luke uses it one time. And the one time Luke uses the word, it's not parallel to the gospel of Mark. All right? Do you want to know what happened? Luke got Mark's manuscript. He's like, Euthyphro. Seriously, Mark? Are we going to keep saying this? He did a global search and replace. And he took all the immediateties and he threw them away. And just to show that he knew his Greek vocabulary, he used it one other time. He says, not in my gospel. No. Another example of this sort of, this is what Mark means by euthys. He doesn't mean literally immediately. Mark knows that all of these things didn't happen in succession, like one after another, as if the whole gospel could happen in about 72 hours before Holy Week. That's not the idea. When Mark says euthys, or immediately, what he means is, this is the word, next thing you know. That's what he means. Next thing you know, right? This is a story told orally, and he keeps saying next thing you know. Another example of Mark's writing style said he likes to use a little conjunction in Greek. It's gar, that's my nickname actually from Garwood. And gar means for, and it's a word he used to explain something. Okay, so Mark sometimes loses his place when he uses this word. The frequent use of gar, these for clauses, function as narrator's asides. They're meant to explain something to the people who are listening to the gospel. But sometimes, I would argue, in the sweep of enthusiasm, in light of the oral background of the Gospel of Mark, they are technically misplaced. Okay, and I'll show you a couple of examples. If we look at the end of the Gospel of Mark, and in my view, the Gospel ends in verse 8. That's a different talk, different story. Probably not worth a flight down, but if you ever want to hear about it, that's what it would take, I guess. And we meet the women at the tomb at the end of in the beginning of Mark chapter 16. And in verse 3, they were saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the door of the tomb?" And looking up, they saw that the stone was rolled back. And this is what Mark says in parentheses. "For it was very large." That didn't make any sense. They wondered, how is the stone going to get moved? And then they looked up and they saw that it was moved. Because it was very large? Well, it doesn't take too much imagination to know what happened there, does it? When Mark says, "For it was very large," what is he talking about? He's talking about why they were asking the question before, but he got ahead of himself. In an oral presentation, you could kind of, after the fact, "For it was very large," right? And you could kind of see how that would work. In writing, it's awkward. And in fact, most of our Bible translations try to make Mark look a little less clumsy at that point. Trust me, he's that clumsy at that point. Well, the same kind of thing happens in Mark chapter 11. By the way, I'm not denigrating Mark's gospel, I'm characterizing it. Right? There's a difference. If you understand what it is, then you can appreciate it for what it is, rather than having it live up to a standard that, in fact, it's not quite aspiring to. Look at another passage, and I guarantee you this has puzzled you before, if you've ever heard it read. This is the story of Jesus condemning and withering that poor fig tree from its roots. Remember that story? This is called Arborside. Not directly a breaking of one of the commandments, but it makes Jesus seem petulant and goofy if you look at it. Okay, so here's how the story goes. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. Now, some Bible translations will see if he could find any figs on it. Bad translation, it doesn't say figs. Anything, that's going to matter in just a little bit. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves. And then he says, Mark, for it was not the season for figs. Okay, excuse me? Jesus went to the fig tree to see if he could find something on it, and he found nothing on it, and then Mark explains that it wasn't the season for figs. It's like, Jesus, why are you looking for figs when figs are not in season? It looks silly. Then he withers that poor tree for not doing what he couldn't have done. All right, that's to miss Mark's literary spot. When Mark says, for it was not the season for figs, he is not explaining why Jesus didn't find anything on it. He's explaining why he had to go up and look at it closely in person. Just like it was for the women, that the largeness of the stone didn't explain why it was rolled away. It explained why they were asking the question. Same thing here. Jesus sees a fig tree glorious in leaf. And the text goes out of its way to say, he sees it from a distance. He goes up close to inspect to see if he will find anything on it. And at the season of Passover, he should find pagim, fig buds, which are edible, and which will tell whether this fig tree will ever bear fruit at all. The text is explaining why he went up close to look at the fig tree. He looks at the fig tree, and he sees there's no buds. This tree will never fulfill its vocation as a fig tree. It will never bear the fruit it was created to bear. All right, so does Jesus have a thing against fig trees? Fruitful or unfruitful? No. You'll notice the story is sandwiched around the story of Jesus' temple act. Because there was a temple that was leafy from a distance. Josephus tells us it was a wonder of the ancient world, glorious in its gold face. It's white. When the sun shone on it, it was blinding. It was amazing to look at from a distance. And what is Jesus doing here? He's going to that glorious temple, leafy, and seeing if there's any fruit on it. Will it bear fruit? And he sees that it won't. And he pronounces a judgment. Right? The fig tree story is not about fig trees. Jesus is, like, every now and then kind of loses cool with inanimate objects. It's an acted parable about the future of the temple, which indeed came to its doom, as the Gospels interpret it, under the judgment of God in AD 70. Right? This is how Mark tells the story, but it can be confusing sometimes if you don't appreciate the way he works. Here's another example of what Mark likes to do. The technical term for this is not that technical. It's called the historic present. Now, what we mean by historic present is it's a use of a present tense verb to describe an action that actually, by definition, happened in the past. Okay? So if I'm describing somebody's speech, and I'm telling a story, what I should say is, Bob said, this is what Mark does. Bob says, then Bob says, and then Bill says, next thing you know, Jim says. Are you getting it? You get the picture? You have to do that with your face too, by the way. That's the way Mark tells the story. The purpose of the present, historic present, is to add a vivid, you were there quality to the narration. It's another sign that Mark was meant for oral performance. Now, I'll just tell you that our Bible translations understandably take all of those and turn them into proper past tenses. So you can't know that this happens. They're hiding that from you. The reason they're hiding that from you is because it seems weird. But in fact, it's the typical way that Mark narrates an incident. He uses the present tense to put it to the front of the stage, make you feel like you're in the middle of it. Part of his storytelling technique. Now, this is not unique to Mark, but we have this kind of narration much more frequently in Mark than in any of our other Gospels. Now, the final proof that Mark is meant for oral performance comes in the 13th chapter when Jesus is in the middle of what we've called the Olivet Discourse, this discourse from the Mount of Olives, in which he's talking about the coming destruction of the temple and the sacking of Jerusalem by the Roman army. And he describes this prophetically, and therefore with a bit of ambiguity that's intentional. And right in the middle of everything, he throws in this little comment, let the reader understand. Now, a modern person who reads that little clause, let the reader understand, thinks that this is a direction to them. We're readers, right? And then we're supposed to understand something. Mark doesn't tell us what we're supposed to understand, so it's frustrating. But we think it's a direction to us. It is not a direction to us. The singular reader here does not refer to everybody with their own Bible reading in silence and trying to make their best of the text. Because nobody did that. You didn't have your own text. You didn't read silently. And you didn't get special instructions to you as an individual silent reader. This is an instruction to the lector. This is an instruction to the lector, the server, excuse me, the performer, the interpreter. And at this point, the lector, performer, interpreter can break out of the storytelling and say, you know that abomination of desolation? It's this. Now back to our story. Now we know that's the case because elsewhere in the New Testament, for example, in the introduction to Revelation, it says, blessed is he, singular, who reads, and blessed are they, plural, who hear. Well, why is it singular and plural? Because it's a blessing upon the lector, the person who gives public performance to this text, and then blessing on those who hear. Not to a whole bunch of individual readers with their own printed copies of the text. I mean, thank God that we have them, but that's not how Mark entered into the church's bloodstream. So we can tell, especially from this smoking gun, that indeed Mark is writing as a text that's meant to be performed orally, to be heard, and to be engaged in as a whole story from beginning to end. So our intermediate conclusion is that Mark don't write so good, but he tells a hell of a story. Mark, indeed, I would call the barstool evangelist. Mark's the guy sitting at the bar, on kind of the edge of his bar stool, and saying, then Billy says, and then Bob says, and then next thing you know, and he loses his place, and he says, ah, never mind. Anyway, and then the next thing, and he tells a story that way. Sitting on the edge of his bar stool, moving you to the edge of your bar stool to hear a guy who ain't so grammatically good, but is really a good storyteller. And indeed, behind the grammatical problems is a very clever storyteller. Somebody who actually exercises some significant art in his storytelling. In other words, Mark is a bad writer, like Samuel Clemens' Mark Twain is a bad writer. Right? He's a narrator. He's a narrator narrating in a certain way. And he's no bad writer at all. In fact, he is a clever storyteller. Mark has all kinds of ways to kind of make his point. In a world without typography, and chapter headings and this sort of thing, Mark has ways to connect incidents to each other so that they can be well understood. One of them is called, in the biz, we call it the Markan sandwich. All right, the technical term is intercalation, but come on, Markan sandwich is better than that. This is what Mark does. And you say, well, don't the other gospels do this? They do, but they got it from Mark. Mark will start a story. That story will get interrupted by another story, and then he'll come back to the original story. Do you see why there's a sandwich? Bread, meat, bread, right? The Markan sandwich. You'll recognize these. For example, in Mark 5, 21 through 43, Jesus is called to go heal Jairus' daughter. He is met on the way by the woman with the 12-year hemorrhage. And then he goes and heals Jairus' daughter, who, interestingly, Mark points out, is also 12 years old. Get it? No. But I can see why you put the stories together. Right? The Markan
sovereignty.
Now, the point is, it's not just that you've wanted to weave these stories together. They are mutually interpretive. They have something to do with each other. Well, what do these stories have to do with each other? Two women, both unclean by the standards of contemporary Judaism. One unclean for having been a corpse, and the other unclean for the flow of blood, menstrual flow. And what do they have in common? Jesus meets both of these unclean women, and by virtue of his touch and power, power goes out from him so that the holiness that is intrinsic to Jesus becomes the holiness that takes over their whole beings. In other words, in a world and in a religious context in which it was very hard to be holy and very easy to be defiled, Jesus went through that world with utter fearlessness in the power of the Holy Spirit on mission from God. And the danger to be around Jesus is not that he would become what you are, but you would become what he is. He was dangerous in the best possible holiness sense. He exuded a contagious, healing holiness that made him fearless in the world and all about accomplishing God's mission within it. Jesus was sacralizing a defiled and dying world and making it well. That's what these stories are there to tell us. That's why they're told together. Well, we just looked at another example, which I won't reiterate, but the story of the fig tree, right? Jesus sees the fig tree. Inexplicably, he seems to condemn it for no reason, but we saw what the reason was. And then he goes for an up-close, personal look at the temple. And what happens to the fig tree is an explanation of Jesus' regard for the temple and its future. Just because Mark's sitting on a bar stool doesn't mean he's not a clever fellow. He's a clever and thoughtful, and indeed, I would argue, profound storyteller. Mark also makes use of an ancient storytelling technique which is just simply called the inclusio. An inclusio is a sort of a bookend feature where you have one kind of brief material on the beginning of some material and then at the end, and the material intervening hangs together as a unit by virtue of how it starts and how it ends. Mark uses this on a small scale. He also uses it on a large scale, and perhaps the most interesting example is what we see in the central section of Mark's gospel. All the way from Mark 1 through Mark 8:21, Jesus has told no one to pay attention to the cost of following him. Now, he's called followers. They've responded. But mostly, there's 8 chapters of utter joyful, crazy pandemonium following Jesus as he does his wonders, works his miracles, and teaches his profundities. A pandemonium that creates a certain kind of anxiety, high anxiety, out of Judaism's leaders. That's what the first 8 chapters are about. From the middle of chapter 8 through the end of chapter 10, Jesus is repeatedly pounding, pounding, pounding 2 things. First, he discloses his identity as the Christ, which he explains only makes sense if you wipe out every idea that you previously had about what it means to be an anointed one, a Christ, a Messiah. Because Jesus' messiahship will be accomplished in the cross. In the journey to Jerusalem, in his suffering there, that's where Jesus will be exalted and revealed as God's Christ. That's hard for the disciples to understand. And so Jesus keeps repeating it. 3 times, I think possibly 4, Jesus says, you know where I'm going, right? You know what's going to happen there, right? And every time he does so, the disciples come back with some kind of ridiculous reply. Like, I'm about to suffer and die, and then they're like, whatever, who will be greatest in your kingdom? Really? Okay. So what's going on here is Jesus is revealing his identity as a suffering Messiah, which means to be a follower of Jesus, will mean that we are not people who evade suffering and cost to be his followers, but we follow after his path of discipleship. We follow his path to Jerusalem as one who will suffer, one for the many. And indeed, that will become our vocation too if we're really his followers. That's what he's trying to teach us. Now, in this central section then, we have, it begins with a story of a man born blind. Of a blind man. That is followed then by all of this teaching that I just described. Jesus identifying himself as a Messiah, a certain kind of Messiah, and thus revealing that following him means a certain kind of following. And then this section, right before Jesus enters into Jerusalem, ends with another healing of a blind man. Now, how many blind men get healed in the Gospel of Mark? Two. One at the beginning of the section, one at the end. I want to argue it's an inclusio. But when you look at the two healings, they're rather different from each other. In Mark 8, 22 through 26, there's a man, and it's the only example we have of this in all the Gospels, there's a man whose healing happens gradually, strangely gradually. Remember what he says? Well, that's a little better. I see men as trees walking. Jesus has to do it again. And find out. Okay, good. Well, we found the right prescription, right? That's strange for this all-powerful one who, by a word and from a distance, can heal people and indeed has already raised people from the dead. And then at the end, we have the healing of Bartimaeus. What is Bartimaeus? Does his healing happen in stages and bits and starts? Immediately, because he declares Jesus to be the Son of David. Son of David is just not a polite thing to say. It's another way of saying Messiah. So what are these two healings of blind men about? Well, first of all, let me say they're miracles. And two blind men got healed. But they're also storytelling devices. The story of the man who sees men as trees walking and who comes into sight gradually is an allegory for what's happening to the disciples. They are overcoming a blindness, but only in fits and starts. We kind of get it, but we don't really get it. The man healed at the end is the full Christological disclosure that Jesus is none other than the Messiah. In other words, the story of the two blind men here, they're not accidental, they're not out of order, they're not wrong. It's Mark's way of telling the story and helping us understand everything that falls in between. All right, well, we could say more about these kinds of literary devices. but I want to just conclude with the few minutes that we have left to show the theological profundity of Mark sitting on the edge of his bar stool. And Mark's theological profundity can be seen above all else in his narrative Christology, in his disclosure of Jesus in the form of a narrative. Now, in order to just prepare us for this, I need to say, make this point. Standard issue New Testament scholarship tells us this, that the Gospel of Mark has what the scholars call a low Christology. Right, I can show you 8 books on my shelf that say, Jesus in Mark is just a man. I mean, he's a man with divine powers. He's a special man, even indeed the Christ. But he's just a man. He is not disclosed in Mark's gospel as God. In fact, Mark is an early gospel, and they didn't believe that about Jesus in the earlier years. Now, if I go and read the Gospel of John, by the time the Gospel of John is written, maybe 40 years later, now Jesus he became God. What do you know? Jesus became God from the writing of Mark to the writing of John. And you can go around and say those things, and people don't raise a hand and ask you differently. It sounds exactly right. We expect doctrine in the early church to develop over time, that we have a low Christology, and then it gradually grows into a high Christology. There's only one problem with that. It's completely wrong. I don't mean it's theologically wrong. I mean it's wrong exegetically. It's a misreading, in this case, especially of the Gospel of Mark. And in fact, I would make this point. Mark's Christology, Mark's view of Jesus, is no lower than John's. What's different between the Gospel of Mark and the Gospel of John is the strategy of its disclosure. Like, John just doesn't waste. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Okay? Not a lot of mystery. Well, what that all means is a lot of mystery. But there's no mystery about the plan. The Word, identified as Jesus, is none other than God himself. There you go. Mark doesn't do it that way. Mark does it, not surprisingly now, in a more clever, in a more subtle, but I think in an unmistakable way. And so I propose to you this thesis, and then we'll illustrate it with maybe one or two texts in conclusion. Mark's identification of Jesus as the Son of God in the first verse of his gospel is actually meant to function. You're going to have to hang with this. This is a little challenging. It actually functions on two different levels in his story. This is what I mean. There is a story that's happening inside the gospel. Okay, and I want you to think about this as a stage where you could see a play, right? And when you go to a play, there's a story that's happening up here on stage between the characters. You are not in that story, but you are watching it. Okay? So let's call this the inside or the internal story. And inside the narrative, the phrase Son of God is, as it is in Jewish terminology, a messianic claim. It's a claim that Jesus is the Messiah. It's a claim that is directed toward the characters in the narrative, and it has come to be understood only with great difficulty by them. In other words, this is what's happening when you watch the story. You are watching the Jesus revealing himself to be the Messiah of Israel, and you are watching characters having an awful time understanding what that means. But they get there. Now, one of the reasons we feel so good about ourselves when we read the Gospel of Mark is because we read about people that seem not as smart as we are. That's Mark's strategy. That's what dramatic irony does. Dramatic irony tells the watcher of the play, the reader of the book, the watcher of the movie, that they know more than the characters in the story. Congratulations. Right? And your reward for what you understand that they can't understand is that the narrator has tied a leash around you and is taking you wherever he wants you to go. So you watch the disciples and you say, for heaven's sakes, you guys, of course Jesus needs to suffer in Jerusalem. He's the Messiah. That's what a Messiah is. You see what Mark just did? He made you into a Christological, theological genius by virtue of the lack of understanding of the disciples. He's very clever. That's the story that's internal to the book. But there's another story, and it's happening to the hearers of the narrative. And to the hearers of the narrative, the expression Son of God is a title claiming something more. Nothing less than this. Jesus is God. And it's an understanding that is disclosed in riddle and by insinuation, but unmistakable for all of that. All right, do you see what's happening? So you're getting taught two Christologies, and they hold together. One is that Jesus is the Christ, the suffering Messiah. The other is, as such, nonetheless, he is none other than God himself. And Mark is teaching not one of those things, but both of them at the same time. Now, this text is loaded with these kinds of hints along the way. The primary, but not exclusive, way that Mark discloses this is by citing an Old Testament passage, or alluding to it, and it's a passage that talks about something that is uniquely or exclusively or characteristically true of the God of Israel, Yahweh himself, God Jehovah. and identifying Jesus as the same. In other words, and this is remarkable, in Mark's narrative strategy, he takes the monotheism of Judaism, the exclusivity of the one and one God alone, and then makes the claim, and Jesus is that God also. Whew. Amazing. He does it over and over again. Of course, the whole early church made their claims about Jesus just that way. So he says, speaks of a voice crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord. Well, of course, that's in Mark's gospel, that has to be John the Baptist. And the Lord that he must be preparing for has to be Jesus. Only one problem, which is glorious. In Isaiah, the voice preparing for the way of the Lord is preparing the way of the God of Israel, Yahweh. So you do the math. If John the Baptist is the voice in the wilderness and he's preparing the way of the Lord, is God coming to his people in the person, human, flesh, and blood person of Jesus? Well, Mark's insinuating that right from the beginning of the story. In Mark chapter 2, Jesus has the paralytic lowered through the roof, and he said, of the man, your sins are forgiven. That creates a stir because, first of all, that's not what we came here for. We're looking for a healing. More importantly, who are you to say that this man's sins are forgiven? Only God can forgive sins. Now, did you notice that they didn't say that out loud, but they mumbled it among themselves? And then Jesus says, to show you that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, I say, take up your pallet and walk. Wait a minute. They said only God has authority to forgive sins. Now Jesus says, to show you that the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. Ding, ding, ding. You do the math. What's he saying? That's not happening to the characters in the story because they're not speaking their minds. The narrator's telling you, but you as a reader can say, wait a minute. What's going on here? Well, this repeats over and over. Ben can take you through all of this with great expertise. I'm going to just touch on one last passage, because in some ways, I think it's among the most interesting. So if you turn to Mark chapter 6, verses 48 through 50, we come to another one of those wonderful, if a little strange, texts in Mark's gospel. Jesus is sitting on a hillside. His disciples go out, and they're out on the sea, and he saw that they were making headway painfully. They're having a hard time making their way across the sea, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. Then it says, he wanted to pass them by. Okay. All right, thanks, Mark. What? So Jesus wanted to walk past them? Is that what that means? Well, it could mean that. Until you realize this, what does pass them by mean? What is passing by? Passing by is an Old Testament idiom, starting already in Exodus 33 and 34, for what it means when God reveals himself in all of his glory. What did God do before Moses? He passed him by. And so repeatedly in Job, in 1 Kings, in the Psalter, we see God passing by. It doesn't mean that Jesus just wanted to walk past them while they were in the boat. He wanted to reveal to them his divine identity. How do you reveal a divine identity? Well, only God can trample the waters of the sea. Only God can control wave and wind. God walks on the waters. God treads the seas. And Jesus wanted to display his glory by passing them by. That's what the idiom means. Therefore, it should come as no surprise that when they see him, he says, make the voice that. Fear not. That's what you say in a theophany. Fear not. And then he clinches it with, ego e me. I am. Now, you can translate that, it is I. That's not what Jesus meant. Ego e me, right? When we go to the Pharaoh and they ask who sends them, what should we say? Ego e me.
Tell them, ego in me sent you. I am sent you. Just thus, Jesus, in this sort of unusual passage, is again, to the reader, being revealed as the one and only God of Israel, who is also the suffering Messiah. Mark might be sitting on a bar stool, but he ain't stupid. He's a theologian of first rank. And thanks be to God that his inspired work that reveals to us the Jesus Christ, who is none other than God and our Savior and our Messiah, is also the one whom we follow.